The Chief Judge and the Judge of the Airport Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Airport Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please take your seats. The court will come to order. Good morning. The first order of business today is the case of Staff Sergeant Timothy Bazar. Are both sides ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Spinner, I understand you want 10 minutes in reserve?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Frank Spinner. My co-counsel is Captain Nathan White. He is not here today. He had a surgical procedure yesterday afternoon. And when we were setting the date for this argument, this was the best day for my schedule and the earliest date, and certainly my client wanted us to get this accomplished. So I just wanted to make sure the court understood that that's why Captain White is not here.
But you're comfortable with going on in his absence?
Yes, and the client was informed of that, and so we agreed to go with this date.
All right.
I have two issues that I'm arguing today, even though we've raised many more issues in our appellate brief. The first issue has to do with the failure to give a mistake of fact instruction as to the age of the alleged victim with respect to the indecent liberties specification, which was specification 1 of charge 2. I think the law is very clear. I don't see really any dispute between the government and the appellant with respect to the rules that govern when a mistake of fact instruction should be given. And certainly it's a very liberal rule in the sense that if there is some credible evidence that raises the issue, whether it's part of the defense theory of the case or not, the instruction is a required instruction. And if anything, what surprised me most about this particular record is that no one discussed it. The judge didn't bring it up when they had the instruction session. The defense did not request an instruction. And so we have a situation where the specification, one of the elements of the offense is that the victim was under 16 years of age. And the facts of the case established that he was 15 years of age. But the evidence, under cross-examination, the individual testified that he told my client he was 17 years of age. So clearly you have some credible evidence upon which to base a mistake of fact instruction.
Counsel, before you get to that, do you have any case law that establishes that a mistake of fact instruction is required in the indecent liberties of a child's offense? I've seen it with indecent acts. But as far as indecent liberties, have you found it?
I have not found any. So, of course, we're relying on United States versus Zachary. And United States versus Zachary is addressed at length in United States versus Wilson. And that goes sort of back to the sort of broader context in which this case arose, the facts. In other words, you have an individual, my client, who's alleged to have engaged in sexual acts with a 15-year-old male. And he's charged, my client is charged under Article 125, the sodomy statute, two different specifications. And the law, based on Wilson, is pretty clear, even though we're challenging that law. At least, I think CAF probably is the only one that can change that law now. We don't know that this court can do that, but we certainly potentially will be asking CAF to do so. But he does not have, the current state of law says under Wilson that there is no mistake of fact defense as to age for sodomy. But there were two specifications of sodomy in this case, the one under age 16 and then the second one's by force and without consent. He was acquitted, my client was acquitted of the by force and without consent specification. But when you look at Judge Efron's dissent in Wilson, what is so fascinating about it is we have a case where now we have an indecent liberties charge where by inference, mistake of fact would be a defense. When you read Zachary and you read Wilson, I think it's pretty clear that CAF is saying that under Article 134, because an element of the offense says that the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that the alleged victim was under 16 years of age, that that mistake of fact is a required instruction. And the same logic applies whether it's a charge of indecent acts or indecent liberties. I do not read the government's brief to be contesting this point. I read their brief to pretty, in so many words, concede that hypothetically a mistake of fact instruction would be required in an indecent liberties case. And the real dispute is, when you look at the cases, there are very few cases but that are cited by both sides on this point, but when you look at the cases, Hibbert and Taylor are the ones that they cite, those are mistake of fact cases with respect to consent and whether the issue was raised as to consent. What distinguishes, and in fact when you read the opinions in those cases, the court is basically saying, the appellate court, that the defense theories of the case and the evidence when put together indicate that there was insufficient evidence to raise the issue to require an instruction. And the evidence in Sergeant Bizarre's case is basically that it's not that even he said that he believed the individual, the alleged victim, was under 17 years of age. It's that the alleged victim testified under oath and said that he told my client that he was 17 years of age. Now,
Mr. Spitter, why does that matter when the defense was this never happened?
Because the defense, case law says the defense theory of the case doesn't matter for a required instruction. It says the defense theory it may be one factor, but it is, the defense theory does not control the outcome. I mean, that's clearly stated in by CAF.
So just playing this out, would it be helpful for the judge to instruct on mistake of fact when your theory is, hey, this never happened, we don't need it? Could you waive it?
The problem is the law says that a judge must give a required instruction if the evidence is raised, even if it is not part of the defense theory of the case. I mean, that's what the case law says, Your Honor. So there are cases that have addressed this very point. Here's the problem, though, that the defense faced in this case, because they did, I mean, this is why it's sort of a strange posture in which this issue arises. The defense did request a mistake of fact instruction as to sodomy.
Correct. That's why I'm right. Puzzled as to why they didn't ask for the other.
Well, actually, it's not puzzling at all, Your Honor. I think it's pretty clear that if the reason the defense brought that up is because they wanted to have a mistake of fact instruction. I mean, it's clear to me, at least, as a defense counsel, that the defense wanted to present a mistake of fact defense as to age. But the law says they couldn't do it for sodomy. So now the problem the defense faced is, from a theoretical standpoint, is, well, now if we come in and say a mistake of fact as to age under the indecent liberties, then we're conceding that something happened with respect to the sodomy. And so, unlike those other cases where you can reasonably see why the defense counsel did what they did in those cases, in this case, the defense faced that problem, dilemma of, we can't raise mistake of fact as to sodomy, but if we raise it as to indecent liberties, now we're conceding that maybe the sodomy occurred. And so I would say it was sort of they were forced into a tactical decision to contest the sodomy outright and then let whatever happen with the indecent liberties. And even
coming in after the fact asking for that instruction when it wasn't asked for at trial. So you want to give the instruction now that he was convicted, versus being put in the
sort of... No, the law says there should have been instruction. It's not that I want it, it's the law says it. I'm arguing it because I read the law and that's what the law says. It's not a matter of... first of all, why didn't the judge bring it up? I mean, that's a rhetorical question, but why didn't the judge bring it up? Why didn't the judge say, hey, defense, you asked for this mistake of fact as to age instruction on sodomy, but you didn't ask for it on indecent liberties. You cited Wilson. I read Wilson, and it's clear that it should be clear from Zachary and Wilson that there's a mistake of fact issue here. Do you want the instruction or not? Wouldn't it be nice as an appellate court if we had a record on that?
Yes.
Exactly. And so, but I think CAF law is so clear on this point that defense theory does not matter. I think the law is so clear on this point, and it is so clear in this case that there is some credible evidence, i.e. the alleged victim saying, I told him I was 17, that the instruction is required. I just don't think there's any question about that. I mean, to me, this is a cut and dried issue. This is almost on the border of being a no-brainer for an appellate court. That's how clear the issue is.
Maybe we could then move on to another issue I'm sure you're going to bring up. It's how did this harm your client? I didn't catch it in your brief, and maybe I just missed it, but what was the harm to your client?
Well, the harm is because first of all, the members acquitted him of by force and without consent. Now, that suggests that the court members thought that whatever happened may have been consensual, but just that he was underage. So to me, as a litigator, that tells me that if they'd been given an instruction that there was a mistake of fact as to indecent liberties, they would there is a strong likelihood that they would have acquitted. So the prejudice here in the posture of this case, where they acquitted him of the offense by force and without consent, implying that they weren't convinced that there was no consent on the sodomy, means that if they had been told about this mistake of fact offense, they would have acquitted him. And I think to the extent that there is a prejudice standard, it's a beyond a reasonable. It was harmless. The government would have to establish that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I can't think of any more clear evidence of the potential of success of a mistake of fact instruction than that. Unless the court has any other specific questions on that issue, I'm prepared to move on to the other issue.
All right.
Okay. With respect to what is identified as the assignment of error number 3 in the case, this has to do with the sentencing case now and the fact that the government brought in uncharged misconduct and basically argued that this was rebuttal to character evidence provided by defense witnesses, both in statements and in testimony at trial. I think that the best way to understand the issue is really more of a 403 balancing than it is anything else. It's clear from the record that the judge was frustrated with the defense counsel. It's a Friday afternoon, and all of a sudden this issue pops up where the government wanted to call, I think it was an OSI agent, to testify about somewhat similar uncharged misconduct, and based on the fact that the rules of evidence had been relaxed upon the presentation of the defense sentencing case. There was a clear factual dispute, though, that developed in the Article 39A session on this issue, wherein the defense provided evidence. Well, let me first state what happened. First of all, you have the investigation that begins against my client. Then you have, and chronologically speaking, this may make it easier to follow. The date of the offense appears in the charge sheet is 15 May 2007. In March through May of 2008, the OSI, working with San Antonio Police, set up an opportunity for my client to engage in communications over the internet with what at trial the government was claiming was either a 14 or 15 year old boy. So that's March to May 2008. It's September 2008 when my clients finally called in and interviewed about these allegations. And then the charges are preferred on 10 December 2008. And so what the government was saying was that this Bobby Ramos, hypothetical character, it was a sort of a sting type situation, was communicating with my client and talk about sexual matters. And so the government says this is the same as the charged offense. And they're saying it's admissible because defense witnesses said in sentencing that when Sergeant Bizarre makes a mistake, he learns from his mistakes. And so they're saying this is rebutting that kind of testimony. The problem is that the defense produced exhibits defense exhibits Alpha Alpha and Alpha Bravo that are screenshots of the profile or something comparable to a profile of Bobby Ramos, saying that in August of 2008 he was 17 years old. And so, to me, at the heart of the matter is that the defense is saying, number one, it's not the same offense, because this is just communication over the Internet. Number two, the individual in his profile says he's age 17. And the judge didn't take the time to try to get to the bottom of that factual issue, because I don't think anybody will question that this is highly prejudicial, highly inflammatory evidence. And the government used it that way. There was no limiting instruction. The government basically in their sentencing argument, in their closing sentencing argument, says he's done it twice. And the judge never tells the members, hey, you can only use that to undermine the opinions of the witnesses. The judge doesn't instruct them that you can only use that to consider Sergeant Bizarre's rehabilitation potential. The judge just lets that fly in, saying, hey, he's done this twice, as though he's now been convicted of two comparable offenses.
Where was defense counsel requesting
that? That's a good question, Your Honor. And I deliberated raising ineffective assistance of counsel on that issue. The problem, though, is the judge was driving the train at this point. He did his 403 balancing. He said it's coming in. He didn't appear to care that there was a factual issue. And he made no effort, sua sponte, to give a limiting instruction. And so even if the rules of evidence are relaxed, all that means is hearsay comes in. But it doesn't mean that in the 403 balancing, you say that the probative value of this evidence is not substantially outweighed by the unfair prejudice. Well, in this instance, the hearsay statement of one agent who says he talked to some San Antonio police investigator, and that investigator told him that the profile that they used was 15 years old, that has a very low probative value. Even if it's admissible, the probative value is so low, especially in light of the defense evidence that showed a screenshot where Ramos was 17. I don't see how the judge could say that had probative value at all without bringing in this San Antonio detective to testify and or to provide documentation showing that, in fact, they were representing Ramos as being 16 years of age or higher.
Do you believe that the defense counsel, the prosecutor, should not have been able to test the witness's opinion with respect to what they said concerning rehabilitative potential and learning from his mistakes?
Right. I believe that the prosecutor, it's a good faith basis, is all that's required. I believe the prosecutor did not have a good faith basis to ask that question because of this issue on what age Ramos was being portrayed as. And it's clear from the 39A session when the defense counsel addressed that there had been, the defense counsel was aware that this Ramos thing was out there, and there had been apparently some discussions between counsel on that point. And so the defense apparently thought that they weren't opening the door, and the government believed they did. And so when they laid that out before the judge just seemed to accept at face value the prosecutor's representation that we're asking this question on a good faith basis. I don't know why the government couldn't show something objective that memorialized that Ramos' profile or representations were that he was 16 or that he was 15 or 14 years of age. I can't explain that. It seems to me if the government wanted to establish that they had a good faith basis, then they should have produced some evidence more than just this questionable hearsay by the by the OSI agent that that was the case. And I believe my time is up for my initial argument.
Anything? All right.
Government counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Orr, may it please the Court. I'm Major Charles Warner, along with Mr. Roger Bruce. We represent the United States government in this case. Your Honors, the defense can't have its cake and eat it too. And that applies to the defense entitlement to an affirmative fact instruction when it contradicted the entire defense theory at trial, and it also applies to the defense's ability to restrict rebuttal evidence when the defense opens the door to a wide ambit of rebuttal via character statements, witness testimony, and the accused's unsworn statement, seeking to establish not only that the accused never makes the same mistake twice, but that he has good military character and, in the words of one defense witness, good character as a model citizen. Your Honors, moving to issue two first, wanted to address a few of the points made by appellate defense counsel here regarding the trial tactics and how that put defense in an untenable position here. The government would respectfully respond that there's another case where the defense was forced into a difficult litigation position, and that case was United States v. Hibbard. And in Hibbard, our Superior Court found that the defense theory at trial was not irrelevant, as appellate defense counsel apparently believed it to be, but rather was an important consideration in determining whether under the totality of the circumstances the evidence reasonably raised the affirmative defense, in that case, of consent. And the reason why the court found that the defense theory and evidence presentation was relevant to that fact was precisely because it's necessary to determine the context of that evidence. A statement of, in that case, well, at least this was consensual, could provide the basis for establishing an honest mistake of fact, as this court found in an unpublished decision in the Hibbard case. However, in context, where it was completely contrary to the defense's theory at trial, as said by the accused in a sworn statement to begin with in that case where he disavowed any sexual relationship, similarly here, a statement that, and you told the accused you were 17, didn't you? Yes. Within the context of a cross-examination that was used to attack the credibility of a witness whom the accused not only claimed to have no sex with, but no knowledge of in his sworn statement to OSI, presents the exact same factual circumstances. To put it another way, Your Honors, in order to find that a mistake of fact instruction was required here, this court would essentially have to overrule United States versus Hibbard, a decision from our Superior Court, because the two cases are, for all intents and purposes, factually and legally indistinguishable. And going through, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the judge is not bound by the defense's theory of the case, aren't they? Determining when a mistake of fact instruction is required.
That's entirely correct, Your Honor. There is a sua sponte duty for the military judge to issue an affirmative defense instruction when the evidence reasonably raises it. The government's contention here, and the CAF's contention in Hibbert, is that in deciding whether the evidence reasonably raises it, we must look in our totality of the circumstances consideration to what the defense theme and theory were to get that statement context.
It was the government's witness who said, I told the accused I was 17 years old.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was in the context of defense counsel's cross-examination, not for the purpose of attempting to establish that when the accused showered with D.W. in this case, that he would thought that D.W. was 17 years old, but for the purpose of showing that D.W. was a liar, as they went through 70 pages of cross-examination, focused almost exclusively on prior inconsistent statements, allegations of prior false allegations of sexual abuse directed against D.W. In that context, this was not an attempt by the defense to present a mistake of fact as to age. This was an attempt by defense to show that D.W. would lie about absolutely any and everything for the purposes of discrediting his underlying story.
I understand what you're saying, but I guess, isn't the standard some evidence? There has to be some evidence raised?
Yes, Your Honor. And
wouldn't your one question, one answer scenario here be some evidence that would have caused the instruction to have been required?
Yes, Your Honor, but similar to Hibbard, the standard was the same there, some evidence. And in Hibbard, it was an express expression of the accused's state of mind in that case. The accused's state of mind, where he said, immediately following the incident, well, at least this was consensual. And this is vital, Your Honor, because in Hibbard, what we have that we don't have here is context. In United States versus Hibbard, the factual context of that statement was brought out at trial through the victim's testimony when she was placed this entire incident into context and repeated this statement that the accused said as they were walking back immediately after the alleged rape, well, at least this was consensual. Here, we have no context. Here, we have a question and answer, and you told the accused you were 17, didn't you? Yes. With no context. We don't know whether this was before, during, or after the events at issue.
Isn't that a question for the members to decide whether it applies or not, not whether it needs to be given?
But, Your Honor, the point to be made here is if in Hibbard, a contextualized statement by the accused expressing his state of mind directly was found not to reasonably raise the evidence, where it contradicted the entire defense theory at trial, based upon the accused's blanket denial. Similarly here, where we have a non-contextualized statement in the identical situation where the accused has refused to admit any knowledge or any sex with the victim, that is an even stronger case than we had in Hibbard. So if Hibbard is still good law, because this statement even lacks the context expressed in Hibbard, this case is an even easier call than United States versus Hibbard.
So what you're saying is that there would have been no reason to believe the accused on this point? The witness on this point?
Your Honor, the issue is not whether there is reason to believe the witness, which is a separate entity. The witness is being cross-examined for their credibility. That's exactly correct. The issue is in determining whether it was reasonably raised for affirmative defense purposes, what the relevance of the defense theory and evidence presentation was. And the defense, and that's why we look at the context of that cross-examination, Your Honor, where it was being used to attack her credibility. There were no follow-on questions, and so that's what he thought. And so you told him that immediately before you went in the shower, or you told him that before you had sex, or you told him that when you were talking on the phone, or you told him that when you were emailing. Absent any of that those types of questions were the types of questions that one would expect you would use to create the inference that the accused here might have been under the misapprehension that a 5'2", 103-pound, 15-year-old boy was actually 17 years old. There are none of those contextual questions here. It's even weaker than it was in United States versus Hibbard. And just as the accused in Hibbard was faced with a difficult litigation decision, that does not exempt him or entitle him to an instruction here on appeal. Essentially what I understood appellate defense counsel to state was that because they were in such a difficult tactical position at trial, where to gain an affirmative defense instruction, one would have to contradict your client's sworn statement that said, I don't even know who this kid is. Because of that difficult factual choice, naturally, they couldn't have argued for it, but you should still give it on appeal. Hibbard says no. Hibbard says that when we look at the context of this information, that deciding if it's reasonably raised has to include a consideration of what the defense theme and theory was, because that is the only way that those facts should be reasonably understood at trial.
But counsel, wouldn't it at least be reasonable for the judge to even discuss it? I mean, you raised it in a pretrial motion for mistake of fact. All these events, as alleged, happened on the same day. He didn't grow 2 years in one day. So having said that, Why wouldn't the judge ask, well, wait a minute, if it's mistake of fact on the first charge, why isn't it on the second?
Well, Your Honor, here, unfortunately, the defense counsel gave even less help to the military judge than the defense counsel did in Hibbard. At least in Hibbard, the defense counsel specifically asked for mistake of fact instruction at the close of findings. Here, there was no mistake of fact instruction requested for this specification, and we know it wasn't an oversight, and we know it wasn't a mistake based upon the pretrial 39A where the defense counsel raised Wilson and basically asked the military judge, disregard Wilson and advise as to affirmative defense for age for sodomy. The judge said, no, I'm not going to. This wasn't an oversight by defense counsel. This was an intentional decision not to ask for it for understandable trial purpose, which is why ineffective assistance of counsel wasn't alleged here, because this is exactly what they wanted in this case. An all-or-nothing litigation strategy is risky. But an all-or-nothing, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it still incumbent upon the military judge to ask that question?
But, Your Honor,
to get the affirmative waiver.
Your Honor, given the fact that the short answer would be, under these circumstances, no, Your Honor. The reason being, the similarity between these cases, between Hibbard and the case of the bar, where the defense, if it's relevant to the totality of the circumstances for what the defense theory is and the defense case presentation is, if it's relevant whether the defense asked for an affirmative defense instruction, if that was not error in Hibbard, where they asked for an affirmative defense instruction, how can it be error here, where the defense failed to even ask for an affirmative defense instruction, making it all the more manifest that this was not their preferred theory at trial, that they preferred a straight credibility assault on the victim and relying upon the blanket denials of their clients. So based upon the decisions of the defense, Your Honor, reasonably no, the sua sponte duty did not arise because sufficient evidence was not raised in keeping with our Superior Court's decision in Hibbert.
But defense theory is not dispositive of the military judge's duty to bring it up.
No, Your Honor.
It's clear Hibbert does not change that at all.
No, Your Honor, it does not. But notwithstanding that fact, in a factual scenario almost identical to Hibbert, and if you'll allow me, Your Honor, I'll step through just a few of the similarities that align these cases nearly identically. Both Hibbert and Bizarre denied all sex with the victims in their sworn statements to OSI. And both, when they made their sworn statements, elected not to reference anything with regards to a possible mistake of fact instruction. In Hibbert, no mention of consent. In Bizarre, no mention of age. Secondly, that affirmative defense instruction would have contradicted and eviscerated the primary defense theory at trial in both cases. And like Hibbert, who could not advance a consent theory at trial because he was would have essentially been conceding guilt to a false official statement charge. Here, Bizarre couldn't advance that theory of mistake of fact as to age because he would essentially be conceding that he lied in his sworn statement and therefore undercut the defense's entire theory. Next, the defense counsel in Hibbert and Bizarre never directly argued at opening, closing statements that the affirmative defense ever applied. Under those factual similarities, Your Honor, these cases are aligned on all the pertinent aspects, and while it is not dispositive, it was persuasive enough for CAF under identical factual circumstances that it should be persuasive enough here. Hibbert remains good law, it has not been overruled, and it does not cut away from the sua sponte duty of the military judge. It simply stands for the narrow proposition that under unique circumstances where the defense theme and theory are directly contradictory to this mistake of fact instruction, and the only thing we have is one stray comment in the record that it is not error for the military judge not to instruct upon it, and that case should be even stronger here where it appears to be an intentional decision never to seek the instruction by the defense counsel.
Let's say we disagree and we find that it should have been raised going to the step of prejudice. How does the government meet its burden of showing this was harmless beyond reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor. First off, the government would respectfully disagree with the accused, with appellant here, where they cite United States versus Davis in their brief, essentially for what the government read, as if there was implied prejudice here under United States versus Davis. The government would first say that Davis does not stand for that proposition. In Davis, the court found no error in failure to give the affirmative defense instruction in the first instance, and found it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt not to give the LIO instruction. So Davis is an apposite to this case. Instead, the government would point this court to United States versus Diapola, And DiAppola stands for the proposition that in order to find it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, we have to determine whether, absent the error, the members would have found the same way. And here, it's important to consider that to walk through that entire analysis. The error here would have been failure to give the affirmative defense instruction. Under that affirmative defense instruction, it would have been the appellant's burden to demonstrate by preponderance of the evidence that he had an honest and reasonable mistake of fact. So in order to find error here, this court, in reviewing the entire record and the totality of the circumstances, would need to find sufficient evidence that a rational finder of fact could have found by a preponderance of the evidence presented at trial that DW was under the, was, that the accused had an honest and reasonable belief that DW was 17 years old.
Here, did DW tell him he was 17?
Yes, Your Honor, but we again need to look at this within context. The context being, first and primarily, the physical appearance of the young man at issue here. The government put a picture of the accused on as one of its, I'm sorry, a picture of the victim on as one of its prosecution exhibits. That would be prosecution exhibit 5. The young man was 5'2", 103 pounds. While certainly there could be some diminutive 5'2", 103 pound 17-year-olds out there, the information combined with the fact that DW didn't have a driver's license, which someone over the age of 16 would seem to have, obviously didn't have a car, which is why he was meeting with the appellant.
So I got my first car when I was 22.
Yes, Your Honor. We're saying, but taken into the consideration the totality of the circumstances, when you were 22, Your Honor, I know that you weren't 5'2 and 103 pounds. The circumstances at work here is that looking at the facts as presented at trial, not as we would have them, not as we would have them be later on, but as presented at trial, all we have is one statement by the accused, by the victim to the accused that he was 17, and then that not only has to be honestly felt, and honestly believed, but reasonable under the circumstances. To be reasonable, we would have to rebut the physical appearance, the absence of those indicia of majority, driver's license, access to car, all those things, the surreptitious hiding from the authority figures.
I'm from the inner city. A lot of folks just don't drive because it's a pain in the butt to have a car. You just take mass transportation. So I don't see how driver's license helps either.
Well, Your Honor, first off, the government would say flat out, we don't reach prejudice in this case. Flat out. But secondly, on prejudice, it's every single detail has to be looked through the prism of this young man's physical appearance. And did he reasonably think that this young man of such diminutive stature could have reasonably been 17 years old? And we also don't... I'm sorry.
How do you determine that for a 17-year-old versus a 15-year-old? What is the bright line test you're asking us to apply with respect to a reasonableness on making that determination?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, there is no bright-line test in these circumstances. It's a case-by-case.
You're leaving that to the members to make that decision and not...
Yes, Your Honor, and in the context, we again need to look at what the members were given. The members were given a decontextualized statement. Again, for it to be honest and reasonable and even applicable, they would have had to found that that statement was made prior to the offenses in this case. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of when the statement was made. So we're asking for presumption on top of presumption on top of presumption instead of evidence for the members to arrive at this decision.
I do need to ask this. And this is the government's witness. The government premised their entire case on what this kid said. There was no physical evidence with respect to the sodomy, with respect to the indecent liberties, with respect to the liquor issue. There was some corroborating evidence, but the only evidence of those actual events occurring came from this young man. So what you appear to be saying is, you can believe him for everything he said on the stand with respect to what occurred, but by God, don't believe him with respect to what he may have told the appellant as to his age. And you want them both ways, counsel. At least that appears to me.
No, Your Honor, and if that was the appearance, then that was my mistake in the presentation. What we're saying is, in order for the statement, the young man very well may have said, I'm 17, at some point. The government's point is, we don't know when that point was, so its relevance to the affirmative defense in the first sentence is speculative. Secondly, in in relying upon that representation, it has to be a reasonable belief, and under all the circumstances, it doesn't appear that that would be reasonable. The third point is, in assessing whether this was prejudicial to the accused, it should also be taken into account that if this affirmative defense theory, if believed, would eviscerate the defense's entire theory at trial that they had offered up and that they argued to the members at opening and closing. And because the defense essentially got exactly what they asked for in presentation, one wonders the prejudice that redounded to a substantial right when that was his intentional litigation choice, and there's been no allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel here. If there are no further questions on this point, the government would briefly move to Issue 3 in our remaining time.
All right.
Your Honors, with regard to Issue 3, the government would like to make a few preliminary points about the role of rebuttal evidence. First off, rebuttal evidence is governed by, as this Court knows, 1001D. And in a case cited by appellant, United States v. Hallam, and also in a future CAF case, United States v. Sathright, the Court held that the ambit of rebuttal evidence is larger than what the ambit of the government's evidence presentation would be in their case in chief. Stated another way, evidence doesn't have to be independently admissible as aggravation evidence in order to qualify for rebuttal evidence. Rather, rebuttal evidence, the evidence that the accused at trial decides to provide in sentencing is going to govern the scope of the rebuttal evidence for the government at trial. The legal function of rebuttal evidence, the Court said in United States v. Sathright, CAF 2004, the legal function of rebuttal evidence is to explain, repel, counteract, or disprove the evidence introduced by the opposing party. In Hallam, the government was specifically permitted to provide rebuttal evidence in the form of witness testimony in response to character statements here. So any argument...
Counsel, even assuming rebuttal evidence is broad, doesn't it have to be factual? Because I think that's what Mr. Springer is saying.
Yes, Your Honor, and no, it does not. Emphatically, no, it does not. In United States v. Hallam, the Court said, using the language of the Court, these were just the opinions of three men about the performance of this man as an Army medic. Opinions. Emphasize, opinions. And then those opinions were rebutted with evidence from an Army CID agent about the accused dealings of hashish. Hallam stands for the proposition that opinions may be rebutted with fact. In fact, Hallam, reading down further, Your Honor, the distinction I think that appellate defense counsel is perhaps confusing is that statements from the unsworn may only be rebutted with aversions of fact, and the Court cites to that case law. So there's two different standards here. When we're talking about unsworn statements, then we can only rebut assertions of fact. When we're talking about good military character mitigation evidence, Hallam stands for the proposition that mitigation evidence in the form of a glowing soldier defense, or what we might call a good military character defense, is rebuttable through factual particulars.
That was my question. I wasn't saying you can rebut an opinion. I'm saying the information you're using to rebut the opinion must be factual.
Well, and in this case,
I'm sorry,
Your Honor. I thought you were saying that it's improper to rebut opinions with facts.
No.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Okay. And so, Your Honor's question is, it's a reliability question as to the factual rebuttal in this case?
Correct.
With the defense exhibit? Thank you, Your Honor. That's another point that the government wanted to reference. Respectfully, the government thinks that this is a red herring issue. The initial determinants of admissibility for evidence are governed by MRE 104B. Here, we imagine the defense's contention would be that this was only conditionally relevant if the age of the person on the printout, Bobby Ramos, was under the age of majority. So if he wasn't under the age of majority, then it wouldn't be on-point rebuttal to say that he never makes the same mistake twice because he wouldn't be soliciting a minor via the internet for sex. Okay. The standard for conditional admissibility there is just for the military judge to make that initial determination on admissibility is some evidence that a rational trier of fact could find that this occurred by preponderance of the evidence. And that factual finding, Your Honor, is reviewed by this court for an abuse of discretion, which as a finding of fact is a clearly erroneous standard. So in order to overturn the military judge in this case, this court would have to find that there was no facts in the record to support the judge's finding that there was some evidence upon which a rational trier of fact could find that this occurred. And, Your Honor, Special Agent Gonzalez's testimony more than satisfies this very modest level. Special Agent Gonzalez testified, factually, in detail, about the sting operation between the Leon City Police Department and OSI in setting up this Bobby Ramos profile to see if appellant would again engage in soliciting a minor for sex. The defense was properly permitted to attack that assertion through cross-examination, but as an initial matter, in order to keep it out of evidence, we looked to 104B, and it's simply impossible to say that there was no factual record here at trial to support the military judge's finding. That finding, that factual finding, is again reviewed for a clearly erroneous standard, and within that clearly erroneous standard, it has to be that there's no facts that the judge could have pointed to in the record that a rational finder of fact could rely upon to prove this by preponderance. The fact that defense counsel vigorously cross-examined and then produced, we must note, Your Honor, as we did in our brief, an unauthenticated screenshot without any dates on it of this Bobby Ramos profile, despite the fact that defense counsel, the government was criticized for not producing more factual evidence besides sworn testimony from Special Agent Gonzalez, more factual evidence to substantiate its claims that this young man was 15. The defense presented a screenshot when they had access to a forensic expert who they did not produce at trial, did not provide telephonic testimony to say when and how and where he accessed this, and bereft of any additional details. That evidence is certainly dubious. While it was the proper form for cross-examination and the defense was indeed entitled to admit it in serve rebuttal, it doesn't undercut the factual basis as on a preliminary basis to get the evidence before the members to begin with in rebuttal.
Can you
yes, Your Honor.
To prejudice in this case, I mean, it'd be one thing to test the knowledge of the witnesses, understanding and opinion, but then to then come back in rebuttal and put this information on, one, could be considered cumulative, and two, certainly there's a prejudicial value to this. So can you, one, talk to that, and two, what was the military judge's duty to give a limited instruction to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
I didn't see that. If you did, you can correct me, but I didn't see that.
Yes, Your Honor, you're correct. There was no explicit limiting instruction. There was, however, the standard, you may only punish the accused for those offenses of which he's been found guilty. So that would disallow any additional punishment for uncharged misconduct. But you're right, there was no tailored instruction. What we do have, and I'll just address that point first, Your Honor, since we're there, is a self-limiting instruction by trial counsel during his initial closing argument where he said, consider that in deciding if Sergeant Bizarre has good military character. And I apologize for not having the direct record cite for you, Your Honor, but that self-limiting instruction told the members precisely how to use the Bobby Ramos information. And in terms of improper use of the Bobby Ramos information, the use of the term predator was used strictly in regards to talking about the accused charged and convicted misconduct against DW in this case. At page 681, 682, 683, 686, 687, and 694, referring to the appellant as a predator, that he preyed upon this 15-year-old boy who was having these family problems. So the predator was cabined to go to the charged misconduct, as it should have been. So any insinuation that one who does things more than once is a predator, that was not how this was argued. The predator aspect was argued with regards to solely the charged misconduct. Now, Your Honor, with regards to the prejudicial effect of this information, when it's not being argued in an inappropriate way, it doesn't have any unfair prejudice. Was it prejudicial? Absolutely. Was it unfairly prejudicial is the standard under MRE 403. There was no unfair prejudice here, as there was no confusion to the members in an argument by trial counsel in their opening sentencing argument that said, use this to consider whether he has good military character. That's the appropriate use. What we have in the rebuttal argument is a brief, fleeting reference by trial counsel, he did it twice, punish him. Taken in the totality of the entire sentencing argument, as this court always considers, that statement was qualified both by trial counsel's earlier limitation on himself to only use it for good military character and the military judge's standard instruction that you should only punish him for those offenses of which he's been convicted. Under those circumstances, Your Honor, the government does not believe that this would rise to a level of substantial prejudice for Article 59A purposes, Also, Your Honor, we would point out that any error on the rebuttal sentencing argument would have to be evaluated for plain error because there was no objection. And so certainly this does not rise to the level of plain error under those circumstances, and the government respectfully submits doesn't amount to prejudice. Your Honor, if there are no more questions, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Your Honor, in sum, the appellant can't have his cake and eat it too. In a circumstance of trial where the appellant's chosen litigation strategy was directly adverse to a affirmative defense instruction, the evidence did not reasonably raise that instruction or the military judge's sua sponte duty to instruct. Similarly, the rebuttal evidence here was tailored to rebut statements regarding appellant's good military character and was accompanied by a self-limiting instruction by trial counsel to ensure that the members considered it in the appropriate way within the context of the entire sentencing argument. For these reasons, the government respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm both the findings and sentence in this case. Thank you.
I would like to pick up with issue 3 and then go back to issue 2. I think that this argument about self-limiting instruction is a joke. And I can't even believe that they would seriously make that argument. When you look at page 695 in the record, and I know at the JAG school, since I taught there and maybe you all have as well, you talk about primacy and recency. And the most important point that you make as a trial counsel in a sentencing argument is the last point you make in rebuttal after the defense counsel has argued. And on page 695, it says, lines 6 through 10 in the record, members, you found him guilty of anally sodomizing a child. You've seen evidence that his character is not what they want you to believe, that he's done other stuff like this. This isn't a one-time mistake. He needs to go to jail for a long time, at minimum 10 years. Send him there. Do it. Now, where's the self-limitation in that? Where is the self-limitation in that? Why isn't the judge stepping in at that point, sua sponte, saying, members of the court, you may not separately punish? And they talk about the general instruction buried in all the other instructions that a judge gives in sentencing. Why isn't the judge stepping in right at that point, performing his duty as a judge, and making sure that the members understand at that point that he can, that the accused, the appellant, cannot separately be punished for the Ramos situation? Furthermore, I think the government counsel here really misrepresents the role of the judge as the gatekeeper on evidence, especially in applying the 403 balancing. There has to be, at that stage, a balancing of the proof relative to the prejudicial impact of the evidence. That is the critical point. It's not that the judges, I mean, that the members can hear the evidence and decide for themselves whether or not this Ramos thing occurred or whatever age Ramos was. The point for the judge is to determine how much proof is there of what Ramos's age was or was represented to be over the internet. And the only proof they have is the Air Force OSI agent saying, this is what a law enforcement detective told me. That's their proof. And then the judge has the evidence from the defense, actual screenshots. I mean, the government's the one, they're the proponent of the evidence, not the defense. The defense is challenging the evidence. So when he makes comments about, well, where's their computer expert and how do we know this was truly, the problem is the prosecution is the proponent of the evidence, and now the defense has provided objective evidence that shows that whatever these detectives were saying to each other has no foundation in fact. And the government obviously was sitting anxious and ready to put on this special agent. So why didn't they have the documentary evidence to back it up? There is an appellate exhibit, I forget the number though, that shows the email traffic Because if you recall, the agent who testified had to refresh his memory, and so he read from an appellate exhibit toward the end of the record. And when you read that email traffic, there's no discussion of age whatsoever. Now, I've done enough of these cases to know that usually when they're setting up a sting operation, they're making sure that in that email traffic, the individual, Ramos in this case, is saying, well, you know, I'm only 15 years old or I'm only 14 years old. So it's unequivocally established what's being represented to the person at the other end of the email. And when you read that exhibit, you don't see anything that would have indicated to the appellant that Ramos was underage. So that's a key fact. There is insufficient proof of that fact under the 403 balancing for the judge to rule in the way that he did, and we maintain that this was an abuse of discretion. I would add also that finally, when you look at the case law cited, Hallam, et cetera, in Hallam, I think they said there were no evidence that they could cross-examine about this information. And in this case, as you noted earlier, Judge Rohn, that they did ask there was a witness who wrote one of the letters who was cross-examined on that point, and so the government's argument isn't fully consistent with the case law. Unless there are any questions, I'm going to move back to issue two. On issue two, the government, with all due respect to the counsel, really mischaracterizes Davis and Hibbert. First of all, I may have misunderstood what he said, but in fact, Davis did find prejudicial error in the failure to give a lesser-included offense instruction, and they describe in Hibbert how they came to that conclusion of prejudicial error. I think when you read Hibbert, at the end of the day, it favors the defense position. It does not favor the government's position. Secondly, the government seems to have read Hibbert as a rule of law, and it's not a rule of law. What the government did in the Hibbert, or the court did in the Hibbert decision, when they talked about totality of circumstances, then they recite from the record the facts in that record that met the totality of circumstances. Well, those are the facts in Hibbert. Those aren't the facts in this case. If in Hibbert the alleged victim had said, I consented to this intercourse, you would have a completely different, that's the factual scenario that would be comparable to this case. I told him I'm 17 years old. So Hibbert is a fact-based decision, not a law-based decision. And I think that's an important distinction that apparently government counsel just fails to address. Now, furthermore, they cite Taylor. And in Taylor, at the very end of the decision, which was also a rape case that had to do with consent, The court said, I think it's 26MJ 131, the site is 26MJ 127, at page 131, the court said, there was the utter absence of any hint of a mistake of fact. Well, that obviously is distinguishable from this case, where there's more than a hint. There's the alleged victim saying, with respect to an essential element of the offense, I was 17 years of age. I mean, the government wants to litigate the factual issue, not look at the standard. The standard is there basically some credible evidence from which the members could determine. And in this case, clearly there is. It is also, if you want to get into the broader aspects of this case, and I'm repeating myself now, but you still have to look at the totality of this case and why the defense made the decisions they made. And in that regard, I want to come back to the closing argument of defense counsel. And remember, too, the government argued in this case that the The statement that my client gave to the OSI was false. So even they didn't believe that statement is true, as though the defense was relying on my client's statement to defend their case. But here's the defense counsel's closing argument, the end of her closing argument, page 532 in the record. And you may leave here not knowing what happened. You might, gosh, I don't know, maybe they were in that room together, and maybe they had sex. Probably what happened was this or that, but in this United States courtroom, maybe isn't good enough, probably isn't good enough. More than likely fails to reach the standard by a long shot. The burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, burden of proof is much, much higher than probably, more likely, maybe. It is the pinnacle of our justice system. It means that if you have reason to doubt what Mr. Stahl says, then you must acquit. And so I want to close there saying the defense recognized the members, after they had heard all the evidence, is probably going to believe something happened in that room. Their key argument is you have to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So the argument wasn't as comprehensive as trial counsel states that it didn't happen. I think that in some ways they're almost conceding that something happened in that room. And so that's why the mistake of fact instruction should have been given in this case. And so I conclude my remarks.
I know this is something you mentioned at the very beginning of your the first part of your presentation, but Wilson, are you asking this court to overrule CAF? And if so, how do we do that?
Speaking for my client, the appellant, yes, I do not have an answer as to how you do that.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We've considered them to be very helpful, and there will be lots of deliberation as a result of them. Having said that, there being no further business before this court is adjourned, and we will render a decision in due course.